This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. A number of studies confirm that growing up below the poverty line can have serious health implications. But can it have a lasting effect on the brain? As part of NHPR series The First Decade, we're considering how living with a constant sense of scarcity can actually hijack the neural pathways to the brain, affecting decision-making for a lifetime. Eldar Shafir is professor of psychology and public affairs at Princeton, where he studies human behavior and decision-making in the context of poverty. He's co-author of the book Scarcity, Why Having Too Little Means So Much. Eldar Shafir, great to have you back on Word of Mouth.
Thank you. A pleasure to be with you.
You go through a lot of historic and contemporary research to reveal the psychology of people struggling to manage with less than they need. Less what?
Basically not having enough of whatever resource it is that you are lacking on. If you don't have enough time to do all the things you would like to do in your everyday life, you're having scarcity of time. If you don't have enough money to take care of the things that you consider, you know, essential for your everyday living, then you don't have enough money, etc. Could be calories if you're dieting. It could be friends if you feel lonely.
We know that trauma actually changes the way that stimuli is received in the brain. Can the experience of scarcity change the brain, or is this just going on in the mind?
We, Sandal and I, do not do brain research directly. There is certainly evidence of chronic effects of trauma of living with poverty over years. In some sense, what we do is a little bit different. We look at the momentary effects. We can take somebody and make them poor in time or money. And within a very short time, what you find is that they now devote a lot of their attention to this area where they're feeling poor, where they're not having enough. You end up what we call tunneling. Everything else on the side turns into a kind of fuzzy periphery. We describe in a book a beautiful study where they looked at a school in New Haven where the train track was near one side of the school but pretty far from the other side. And they compare the performance of fifth graders who were randomly assigned to one side or the other. And the kids who are near the train tracks after 5 years at school are about 1 year behind in academic performance, which is, you know, a massive effect. The case we're making in the book is that, well, you don't have enough finances or you're worried about rent or food or anything of that sort. It's like an internal train. It's like these trains going through your mind and interfering with your ability to manage, you know, the rest of your life calmly and well.
So this would, I can imagine, really reduce opportunity for somebody if their brain was doing other things, worrying, perseverating. But something else that you present in the book, an actual lack of imagination. People can't see themselves outside of this cycle.
You know, it's a part of the tunneling issue. As you're doing that, you're living a very, very focused life that neglects a lot of other things that would have been great to take advantage of, including things that could hurt you again, you know, worse tomorrow. So in some sense, we talk about a poverty trap. As you're neglecting things in the periphery, some come back to haunt you. You know, bills you forgot to pay, loans you took at interest rates that were, you know, excessively high, but to which you paid less attention as you're trying to solve a problem today. And all these things end up only making you poorer the next week.
As you pointed out, scarcity is sort of relative in many ways. Not just a poverty trap, but for super, super busy people, there's a scarcity of time. Give us an example of how that might sort of spin out for them.
Well, I'm guessing a lot of your listeners will have had this experience where you're basically running around through a day where there's too much to do and there's a deadline, you know, at the end of the day or the next morning, and there's just not enough time to attend and spend a lot of time focusing on your kids' homework or paying attention to your spouse's, you know, laments about something that happened to them that day. You're tunneling on the problem you have. You do much less well elsewhere. You might sleep less well because you're pulling an all-nighter to get the project done. The next day, there's data on this. When you've spent a night without sleep, you're just a little bit less smart and you do things less well. Very similar to the money issue with the poor.
How about the idea of tunneling for good? I mean, we recently interviewed a woman who wrote about Sherlock Holmes' kind of obsessive behavior in solving crimes. He kind of rides that obsession, that spinning wheel. Can it be used for good?
Well, it's a wonderful question, and it's a very important aspect of our work. If you look at how the poor manage their everyday funds, they do extremely well. They use their dollar. They manage the dollar much better than the rich. They buy things typically very, very carefully and wisely. They know how much they spent on the jar of tomato sauce as opposed to many of us who do not really notice it. They're managing things very well. They're kind of experts on the day-to-day juggle. But as they're juggling so well locally, again, they neglect things in the periphery, some of which are, you know, financially highly relevant to their lives. And so you find this in many places. You know, the students I see every day, when they pull an all-nighter, when they spend 8 hours a day, you know, they finally, after months, disconnect from email and disconnect from Facebook and just sit down and have only 8 hours left and write a paper, they're good at it. You know, many of us joke that what you see people do in college is not the best they can do, but the best they can do in the last moment. Mm. And, you know, they do very well. But the point is that as they've done very well throughout this night of pulling an all-nighter, everything else is neglected. They forget to call their mother on her birthday. They don't sleep as well. They eat less well. Everything else in the periphery is neglected. But again, as you point out, the act of focusing can lead you to very high performance at that moment, very locally.
We're speaking with Eldar Shafir. He is co-author of Scarcity, Why Having Too Little Means So Much. Well, you write about some of the ways that public policymakers and health workers can accommodate or be sensitive to this tunneling and actually help build bandwidth. What are some examples of creating bandwidth?
Here's one way to think about it. We walk around with a very limited mental capacity, very limited bandwidth. We can only attend to a few things at a time. And that's kind of an interesting way to think about it, because what that means is that anytime you give me a little bit of bandwidth somewhere, a little bit of a bandwidth gift, I have more of it now to attend to other things. To the extent that you make my banking easier, more trustworthy, more automatic, more manageable, at that moment, I can spend less time juggling my banking and have more time to, you know, eat well or attend to my kids' homework or anything else I want to do in life. And so the intuition here is, what can policymakers do, especially for people who struggle with poverty? Poverty, in some sense, you know, we're talking about different sources of scarcity as if they're all the same. But in many ways, poverty is a more extreme case. You know, many of us who are very busy, you know, between us, don't tell anybody, you know, there's something we choose to do. We don't have to do it this way. I mean, many of us who are busy because we're trying to, you know, exercise and go to the opera and read a good book and do good work and do better work than the other people around us and stuff like that. And, you know, if we fail to do one of those things, at the end of the day, very often nothing much happens. When you're poor in money, it's a very different story. There, if you fail to pay the rent on time, you're evicted. If you fail to get food on time, you're hungry. It's a much more extreme version of it. Mm-hmm. And so the notion is, what can policymakers do to alleviate some of that juggling, tunneling that's required of the poor to manage their everyday lives? And paradoxically, what you find is that, you know, the less poor often get a lot more help than the poorer. So, you know, we get reminders and automatic deposits and overdraft coverage and friendly banking and all kinds of things, and lawyers and accountants and drivers and nannies and maids and all the kinds of things that help us manage our everyday lives. And basically, for a little bit of money, we get more time. When you look at the poor, the whole thing is much more complicated. It's very hard to get more money for your time. You can work another hour or two and sleep a little bit less, but that's not going to give you much. And you often get a lot less help. You have less reliable lawyers and less friendly banks and less good instruments that help you save for retirement in automatic and painless fashion and all the kinds of things that would make life a little bit easier. So the intuition is that if policymakers design a context where, for example, the poor can resort to short-term loans without going to payday lenders who charge an enormous amount of interest. If we simply made short-term loans available that are not too expensive, there's some evidence showing that would make the financial lives of the poor so much easier to manage, thereby liberating some bandwidth and allowing them to do other things in their lives a lot better.
Well, although the circumstances for the very poor are different than most middle-class Americans, there is a psychological state. You know, one of my friends called it the disease of more. You know, there's never quite enough success or money or attention. Is scarcity a psychological state? And is that something that we can work our way out of?
Well, we certainly talk about it as a psychological state, as a sense of a feeling of not having enough. And whether you can work it out of it or not depends a bit of where you are. So, you know, I'm very reluctant to suggest that people who have a hard time finishing the month and feeding their children should work on having more modest tastes. Mm. It is certainly true that in many cases, you know, both, you know, the richer who feel like they don't have enough money or the very busy who just take on too much and could easily do with less, there it's certainly true that you could imagine, very smart ways of making things better by just, you know, developing slightly more modest wants and needs. It's a deep issue because there's often a critique about work that's done on the American poor saying, what do you mean they're poor? They all have, you know, TVs and
cell phones,
toasters and cars
up.
And what exactly. And that's sort of it's an interesting critique because it sounds sort of superficially like you got a point there, but it really is not very deep. And, you know, imagine I said to you, what do you mean they're poor? They all have running water. That just doesn't seem right. You know, things that used to be a luxury once now have become a basic feature of everyday American life. Yes, internet used to be an unimaginable luxury 20 years ago, but today, when it's a common staple and your kid at school basically needs internet access to do her homework, if you can't afford it, well, then yes, you're poor. And so in some deep way, there is a psychological element to it, because as society changes its norms and its standards, what it means to be poor will change with them, in the sense that there's certain things that you feel you ought to be able to afford, and all of a sudden you can't.
Eldar Shafir, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Eldar Shafir is a Princeton-based psychologist and co-author of Scarcity, Why Having Too Little Means So Much. You'll find more in that book and everything from our special series, The First Decade, including Brian Walston's story on the challenges kids in poverty face when it comes to mental illness. It's all on our series page for The First Decade at nhpr.org.